Hi, everyone, and welcome to Book Hype, episode 122. I'm Brittany, not Jen. Jen is a little under the weather this week, so I'll be taking over and guiding you through our discussion on author Ursula Le Guin and all of her work. Tonight, I'm joined by Karen and Kristen. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Hi. Doing all right. Just got home from work, and my apartment smells like tacos, and I want to eat them now.
You're welcome.
Man, I came home yesterday and my house smelled like tacos and I almost cried because I was just so happy that there were tacos for dinner.
God, tacos just solve a lot of problems.
They really do. Yeah. Oh,
so good.
They make every day better.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The one thing they don't solve is Karen and I's inability to get some reading done this week. So, as we go in to talk about what we're reading, if you've read anything this week and want to let us know or want to talk about anything with us, you can always contact us by reaching out to us on Twitter. We're at BookHype. Or you can comment on this post on Hypeable and let us know what you've been reading, because we clearly need some suggestions and free time. But Kristen got a couple of books in. So what did you read this week, Kristen?
Well, in addition to reading my book by Ursula, because I did finish an entire book. I did it today, but I listened to the entire thing at work. I read book two in the Perfect Gentleman series. I talked about the first book last time. Book two is called Seduction in Session. And it's, I can't get over how well done the political drama and mystery is in here. Like, I wasn't expecting the political drama part of all of this. And like, I guess it's the right time of year for it, and maybe it just kind of clicked, but it's, like, the good kind, and the, you know, the president and all of his friends are involved in a bunch of things they didn't realize they were involved in, and now they're trying to figure out how to get out of trouble, and there's Russians involved, and it's crazy, but it's so, so good, and it's really well done. So if you're looking for a little different kind of political drama than you're currently dealing with, give The Perfect Gentleman a try, because they're amazing. And then later on in the week, I really just needed a laugh at my desk at work. I was like freaking out and was stressed out. So I picked up Play by Kylie Scott again, because I can always count on Play and Lead, which are back-to-back in that series, to put me in a good mood. Play is the single, like, funniest hero I've ever read in a book. Mal is a menace. He's a drummer, and he's insane. And it's just, yeah, when I really need to just kind of get away from things, Play is always a good one to go back to. So there, I have like 10 books to be read on my Kindle right now. The last like 2.5-3 weeks have been insane for really good releases. I can't wait to get into Lauren Lane's newest, the last book in the Wedding Bell series. And Serena Bowen, we read the first book in one of her series last November. She has a new book out today that I am dying to get my hands on, called Keepsake. So I need more time too. There's just not enough time.
I think you found a great balance of lighthearted humor and good times mixed with political drama. It's the perfect time of year for that, because we're going to need some lighthearted reads after the next 2 weeks here in America. If you're not in America, good for you, unless you're dealing with Brexit. But I mean, it's rough everywhere you go, I guess.
It's just a big mess.
Just a big mess. I for one, cannot wait for this election to be over. It looked like it was going to be fun, and oh, I was let down there. All right. Let's talk about some science fiction. And Karen brought up a good point before this episode. What is science fiction, and what makes something science fiction? And I won't reveal what one of her choices is, because I'll let her do that. But my idea of science fiction is something where you're in another type of universe. You could be in Earth, but it's another universe, and you're dealing with a lot of data, and you really need to buckle down and use data and math and, like, you know, really study these other worlds in order to understand what's going on. And so I'll let Karen kick us off and lead us into the discussion of science, what our favorite science fiction is, with her picks.
Thanks. Yeah, whenever I think of science fiction, I always go back to technology. Like, technology tends to be a big factor when you're talking about science fiction, but sometimes I honestly get confused because there are other stories where I feel like they blend science fiction and fantasy, and that line can get kind of blurred, especially when you're talking about other species and other races. And it's sort of like, I think there's some really hardcore sci-fi out there and then some stuff that is maybe a little bit easier to get into. And I think I talked about this a long time ago on Book Hype, but I used to be very afraid to read science fiction. I thought it was going to be too difficult for me to understand. And then I started picking it up here and there, and now it's one of my preferred genres. I don't read as much of it as I would like to, but it's something that really fascinates me. But one of my favorite stories is actually War of the Worlds, which has aliens, and it's set quite a bit in the past, but it's very, what's the word, applicable, I guess, to today. Like, it's a timeless kind of story, which actually brings up a good point, because they're going to be adapting War of the Worlds for television on MTV, of all places, from the creator of Teen Wolf. Jeff Davis is going to be executive producing it, but also the grandson of Gene Barry, who starred in the 1953 adaptation of War of the Worlds, is also working on the project, and I think he's writing it and helping to develop it. So, like, kind of a cool full circle thing, but that story just really fascinated me when I first read it, and I thought that it was very well done and very interesting that it was just kind of day in the life of a person who wakes up and suddenly aliens are coming down from the sky, and what happens in the situations and how do people react to the fact that aliens are just roaming through the streets killing people now. But my other favorite story, which is the one that Brittany, I think, was referring to, is The Martian. The book and the movie, of course. We've talked about this quite a bit on here, but very funny book. Also very based in math and science and hard facts and details and realistic in a sense. I mean, not everything is perfect, but it's one of those stories that I think if it hadn't been written the way that it was, if it hadn't been as funny, would have been very dry and hard for me to get through. But because it is just a friggin' hilarious story, I had no problem with either the book or the movie, and it's become very, very popular, obviously, and for good reason.
So something we learned today, Karen likes the cold, dead rock in the middle of space and anything set there. I love Mars, and I think the War of the Worlds story is one of my favorite things I've ever learned in my life, was hearing how story can affect mass hysteria because of the, like, 1930s radio broadcast of War of the Worlds. It's one of my favorite things to just really imagine sitting there and being so captivated by a story that you panic and think it's a real broadcast. And that's so cool. And I think The Martian is another great example of the movie and the book are just so well done that it's not too far of a stretch to believe that that could be something that happens down the road. Where we have these space exploration programs to Mars. So, yeah, I think both of those are great examples of science fiction and getting down to the math and sciencing some stuff. I'll keep this PG. Kristen, how about you? What are your picks? You have some interesting ones here.
Yeah. Okay, first of all, when you say science fiction, I tend to think aliens and, like, the future and exploration and technology. Like, that's more where my brain goes. But when you talk about aliens, I have to mention Smallville. It's not exactly science fiction because it's based on the comic book, and it's more, I would say it falls more into, like, comic book movie than it does, or comic book story than it does science fiction, but a lot of the plots and a lot of the story that they tell in there is very science fiction-y. Like, you know, him meeting this incredibly intelligent scientist who has deciphered signals from Krypton that helped Clark learn about his past and where he came from and figure out, you know, exactly where he fits in and all of that. I love Smallville so much. So, you know, if we're talking science fiction and aliens, I have to mention it. I'm a huge fan of the original movie Minority Report, the one with Tom Cruise a couple years ago. I fell in love with that movie. I didn't so much like the TV show that they tried to put together a couple years ago, but I really loved just the whole idea of, like, pre-crime and them trying to stop things before they happen. It falls into that gray area of, if you don't commit a crime, how can you be charged with it? But that's all, you know, kind of the fun of science fiction is, like, how far can you go and all of that stuff. I'm also a really big fan of space movies. I always have been. Apollo 13, Interstellar, Gravity. I love them all. It's so much fun. Like, you know, I'm never going to go to space because I have no interest in being out there and terrified. But it's all so interesting. There's so many things that can go wrong. And seeing how they, you know, find a way and use science to solve problems and, you know, all of that. It always just amazes me. And lastly, as far as books go, I'm going to say maybe Armada by Ernest Cline. I just read that this year. And while it kind of fits in with Ready Player One, which more, now that I think about it, doesn't really fit into science fiction, it has a science fiction twist to it that Ready Player One doesn't have. And that kind of separates it and makes it totally different. And I really loved Armada. And it kind of, it's a totally different story from Ready Player One, but yet it totally fits in the same field. Like, you can tell that they're written by the same author and that he's, you know, the type of story he wants to tell. So, yeah, all in all, I think I like science fiction more than I thought I did.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear science fiction, like Karen was saying, the line is really blurred. So immediately I want to be like, jump in and say, oh my God, Star Trek, there's no other thing. But it's not really science fiction. It's more of a space fantasy type of production. And so, yeah, you have data officers and you have Spock dealing with all these logical explorations of things. And, you know, there's a lot there, but it's really not science fiction. It's sort of a hybrid. And so that takes me back to my favorite stories, which are more, they're adventure stories, but they are science fiction-y. And I loved Jules Verne's novels when I was growing up. I must have read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea probably four or five times in elementary school. And Journey to the Center of the Earth. I loved Journey to the Center of the Earth. And, you know, there's a couple of things that while you guys were talking, I had to, like, look up and see, are these books that I keep in my head actually considered science fiction by the masses? And they are. I mean, Jules Verne is kind of crowned the unofficial father of science fiction. And I think that great adventure stories mixed with crazy worlds and finding different things are definitely where, or something that captured my interest when I was growing up. And they're all these stories that I took out of the library seem to fall under a lot of these titles. So Fahrenheit 451 is considered science fiction. I mean, this is according to Google search. There's room for argument, I think, in all of these, but just reading through some of the books that are considered science fiction, it really contains a lot of things that I love. And The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, also up there with the Jules Verne novels. So, yeah. And then there's also, like, Frankenstein. I mean, that's like a monster fantasy, but it is science. So
that's true. Add that to my list.
Yeah, Frankenstein is great. Great, great, great. I reread that not too long ago, too. I can't believe I didn't even go right there when we were talking about this. But the reason we're talking about science fiction is because we wanted to spend an episode talking about Ursula, is it Le Guin? I want to say Le Guin, but I don't know how to pronounce her last name.
I assume Le Guin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
We talked about Ursula a few weeks ago when, in our news episode, one of the articles that we referenced was from the Washington Post, and it was all about the fact that Le Guin's, a collection of her work, is now in a volume in the Library of America, which is a huge honor, and she's just someone who I had never heard of before we had that episode, and I don't think many of us had, but she has written so much, and she has so many short stories, poetry, you know, she's written book reviews, she's written novellas, she's written everything, large epic series of, you know, science fiction books, and she's a really accomplished woman, and I couldn't believe I've never heard of her. And she's one of two living authors now to see her work in the Library of America. Like, she can go and look at it there. And Philip Roth is the other author who is currently in the Library of America. And if you're interested in checking out something of Philip Roth's, American Pastoral was just adapted by Ewan McGregor. He stars in it and directed it, so you can check that out if you don't really feel like reading Philip Roth. I'm looking forward to seeing that movie, so I'll plug it here for those of us who have no time to read but want to go to the movies. If you want to know about Ursula Le Guin and get a great picture of her life, there is a New Yorker article that I'm going to link to in our show notes, and I was wondering if you guys, either of you, had a chance to look at it. It is a long article, and it just came out last week, but it's called The Fantastic Ursula Le Guin, and it is so well written and really just captures the life of this woman whose family was just full of adventurers. They would go somewhere where there was literally nothing. They're settlers and out west, and she lives in Portland, and she just loves that idea of looking out and seeing a landscape and being able to put what she wants on that landscape, and reading these conversations and just getting a really good sense of how sharp and witty and intense she is about everything. She delivers every phrase with purpose and doesn't really have any regrets, I don't think. She just is such a wonderful woman and very, very talented. And were you guys able to read anything more about her before you read her works?
No, I wish I could have, because other than the article that kind of brought us to her in the first place, where she did seem, you're right, I think she chooses her words very carefully, but also she is very quick. Like, she's very decisive in who she is and who she wants, how she wants to be portrayed and how she wants to be seen. And I think that's fantastic. What I have found with her and her work is that it's kind of overwhelming. A lot of the stuff that surrounds her, there's so much of it. There's so much detail. And I think from what little I've read of her, she's absolutely brilliant. And I want to know more and I want to read more, but it's also like, where do you even begin? You know, it just feels like there's so much out there now.
Yeah, I didn't really get a chance to dig into the author before I read the only book I've read by her so far. But, you know, after reading, I read The Lathe of Heaven, which is really crazy title, honestly. And now I'm looking at this New Yorker article, and it doesn't surprise me that the book is set in Portland, and it doesn't surprise me that she works in, like, basically everything that this article describes her seeing from her back porch is, like, plays a distinct role in the book. Like, they talk about the geological features of Portland and, you know, that area and the mountain range, and it becomes like almost a part of the story in the book. So it, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all to kind of see that that's something she sees on a daily basis and all of that. So Yeah, I'm definitely interested in seeing, like, in learning more about her.
Yeah, this article in particular is just a very, very great overview of the woman that she is. She has a note in here where after she was honored by the Library of Congress, and they sort of said offhandedly, like, oh, the living legend, people started referring to her as that. And she has this line in this article, and she says, I'm getting really sick of being referred to as the legendary. I'm right here. I have gravity, a body, and all that. She's just so sharp, and really, she accepts praise, but she wants it on her terms. She doesn't want anything that's about her to come off in any way that is not filtered through her really unique lens. And yeah, what you were saying, Kristen, is right. Even reading what I read, is, you know, you really see her upbringing in it, and you can see this woman who raised. So a little bit about her background, because it does influence her writing. She is a mother of three. She was going for her master's and presenting a thesis in French, and she gave that up and kind of traveled around with her husband, and really, like, he worked on his PhD, she worked on writing, and she got rejected. Like, she wrote like 5 novels and no one was interested. And her first story she submitted at the age of 11 to a science fiction magazine, which is just so cool and interesting. It was rejected, but she did always have that science fiction ingrained in her from a very early age. It was something that she and her brothers were interested in.
But the motivation mm-hmm. to submit an article at the age of 11, I've been writing creatively like most of my life. In fourth grade, I would write little stories, and from then on, I was always writing creatively, but I was always terrified of showing that to somebody other than my mom, who was always like, this is the best thing I've ever read. And it's like, that is exactly your job, mom. Thank you for stroking my ego. But for an 11-year-old to have the drive, the motivation, the dedication, and the strength of character, really, because it is terrifying to submit something like that to a literary magazine, is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and then to go on and early in your career write 5 novels, 5 full novels, and they don't see the light of day anywhere, and you keep writing. And meanwhile, you're raising a family, and you're, you know, moving around because of your husband's job. You're not really settled yet, and you're bouncing from place to place, and you're just keeping your interests and absorbing story after story and really paying attention to. When she was younger, she lived in California, in Berkeley, San Francisco, Northern California area, and just hearing like legends of different settlers in that area in the Pacific Northwest, and just really absorbing and keeping everything together. And one of the things that really fascinated me about her is she had an amazing like life-work balance. There's one whole section in this piece where she's talking about how one of the most violent stories she ever wrote was written at the same time she was juggling putting together her daughter's five-year-old birthday party. And like, how do you do that? How do you like go from like making sure that the cake is ready and having everything done to like retreating for 2 hours and just like digging into this like violence? It was just unbelievable how she's able to, you know, really channel these pockets of creative energy and just really keep building on these stories. And when she finds something she's interested in, she really unpacks it. And that's a lot of themes in her novels, really deal with the contrast of like light and darkness and interplanetary connections and like, you know, civilizations coming together and the disconnect between them and how two things can exist in a person at once. And she's very, very good at unpacking all of that, no matter what she's doing. I read a commencement address by her, and it has echoes of everything I read about her inside of it. And she fascinates me. So I can go on and on and on about her because I just kept reading about her more almost than I did her work. And it was just really, really interesting. I had a good time. But let's do just one little summary of everything that I think is really nicely encapsulated in what's called the Complete Orsina, which is the volume of work that was selected for the Library of America. And this is a snippet of the introduction. So it goes, in a career spanning half a century, Ursula K. Le Guin has produced a body of work that testifies to her abiding faith in the power and art of words. She is perhaps best known for imagining future intergalactic worlds in brilliant books that challenge our ideas of what is natural and inevitable in human relations, and that celebrate courage, endurance, risk-taking, and above all, freedom in the face of the psychological and social forces that lead to authoritarianism and fantasism. It is less well known that she first developed these themes in the richly imagined historical fiction collected in this volume, which inaugurates the Library of America edition of her works. So she's really run the gamut of just creating everything, but really where she's known for, if you were to bring her name up, people would probably recognize her for her science fiction. I did find a couple of pretty fun facts about her that were really interesting to me, and then we'll really get into her actual writing and talk about what we read. So her last name, when her husband and her got married, the marriage license put a space in between the L-E and the G-U-I-N, and they just decided to roll with it because they're easygoing people. So they just changed their name.
You know, I was looking at her last name, like I've seen it, you know, in all the stuff I've seen lately, and it made me think it was French because Le Guin, like, it's not necessarily French, but the way it's written, it kind of looks that way. To find out that the space was just kind of accidental makes it just, that kills me. Because, like, who knows? Who knows what it actually is, yeah. Descent, like, what their lineage is. But I found that funny.
Yeah, because the G is capitalized in the original name. So they were just like, well, I guess it's supposed to be separate. That's fine. We'll separate that.
I mean, it probably was easier than trying to get anything fixed.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
I would be so mad, though.
Yeah.
So mad.
But she's so cool. Another two, really, this is my favorite things about her because they're so cool. The first one will go earlier in her life. She went to Berkeley High in the, you know, San Francisco coast area, and she was in class with Philip K. Dick, and they didn't know each other. And Philip K. Dick wrote Man in the High Castle and tons of science fiction. So it's just, there's something in that Berkeley High water that got this class to really, you know, overhaul the science fiction genre. And also fitting with her Berkeley upbringing, she marched against the Vietnam War and participated in a conga line with Allen Ginsberg. Just, you know, something to add to your bucket list if you're growing up in that area. And she is also well known for being very vocal against Google's digitization of literature. So when Google Books came out and they were putting tons of copyrighted material online for people to look at. Now, granted, Google Books will be like, if you're scrolling through a book and it's like, you can't view pages 37 through 39, and of course your college reading requires you to read page 38, you know, you're going to have to buy the book. But she's very against that. She has fought very publicly and, you know, written letters and has really well known for fighting for fair compensation for authors and, you know, not giving away work for free, which I think is awesome. So that was kind of cool to read up on, and she is a very passionate writer, and so when she digs in. So we kind of touched on the fact that she's written all over the place, and we came up with a little bit of a collection of different types of things that she has written over the years. And we each kind of dove into a novel. And then Karen and I also read some short stories. I read a couple of poems myself, and I read a shorter story and a commencement address. So let's kick it off with Karen. What did you read, and what'd you like? What didn't you like? What really stood out to you?
Okay, I'm actually really glad that you're starting with me, because I feel like I'm going to be the worst one of the bunch. I honestly had a little trouble getting into her stuff. It's not that I don't think she's a brilliant writer, but I think maybe my mindset was off, or I wasn't really sure what I was getting into, but her writing is quite elevated. And I will start off by talking about Earthsea, which is, like, if I've ever heard of Ursula K. Le Guin before, it has been in regards to Earthsea, so, like, vaguely aware that this is definitely, like, a big one for her. I didn't get very far in the book because it's a high fantasy kind of magician's world thing, and it's basically about this kid that has powers and sort of develops these powers. His aunt helps him along. She's not necessarily, like, the best person. And this mage comes in, this wizard who is well-known, and asks him, you know, do you want to join me? And the kid says yes. And then he's frustrated that his mentor isn't giving him enough information and enough knowledge in order to become a great wizard. It's the whole, like, you must be patient, you must learn these things at the right pace, and you must know things that feel inconsequential now in order to understand how important they are later. And the kid ends up leaving him amicably to go to another school to kind of learn more quickly. And it's a great concept and an interesting story in and of itself, but I found the writing, at least in this one and at least in the beginning of this book, to be unconnected. There was this disconnect between me and the character, and that it felt like I was reading the beginning and it felt like a prologue. And then I read the next chapter and it still felt like a prologue. And I was kind of waiting to feel connected to this character, whereas it felt very, like there was just the space between us. And I think this is actually a problem that I tend to have with high fantasy and maybe even sometimes science fiction, in that you see this overview and it's third person that steps back a little too far for me to, like, really feel connected to the character. Do you guys ever have that issue?
Oh, yeah. I think, actually, I had that issue a lot, and we talked about it with our last book, Spontaneous. It just, for some reason, when that disconnect exists, you're sort of discouraged by it, too, when you're setting out into the book, so it makes it harder to then want to keep going because you're just not feeling anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely have run into that myself too. It's just, it's harder to connect when you're almost looking at the entire scene rather than seeing it from one person's perspective or trying to see it from, you know, this character's point of view or whatever. It just makes it harder. So I do know what you mean.
Right. Okay, good. At least I'm not crazy. And I'm sure there's going to be some Earthsea people out there who are like, what are you talking about? Which is, like, totally fine, and I get it. And I'm not giving up on the series, and I'm definitely not giving up on the author because, like Brittany was saying, she's so fascinating, and I'm interested in learning more about her. And sometimes the best way to learn about an author is to read their work, because they put so much of themselves and their beliefs and their morals into their stories. But after I had a little trouble with Earthsea, I moved on to some of her short stories because they're quite easy to get your hands on and they're a little bit faster of a read. And it was interesting. The first one I read was in an anthology called Lightspeed Year One. It was edited by John Joseph Adams, And her short story in that novel, she was amongst many great writers, including like George R. R. Martin, lots of very big people. And I read The Silence of the Asonu. I probably murdered that. But it was just a short story about this alien race, for lack of a better word, that the children talked as kids. The older children would teach the younger children their language, but as these kids grew up, they stopped talking. And the story kind of follows an outsider who comes in, or even several outsiders who come in to try and figure out why they are silent. And it explores this idea of, well, if they're silent, they must be wise. They must listen a lot. They must have a lot of knowledge. They must choose not to talk very much because they feel like they don't want to waste words. And it's also the idea of how language is passed on from generation to generation. But by the end of the story, I was kind of having trouble figuring out what the actual point was. And I kind of like and dislike that about short stories, because they tend to be a little bit more abstract, and I find that interesting, and I find it helps you kind of make up your own conclusions. And one of the conclusions I came to was that the outsiders, you know, when they're looking at other races, and I think this is especially true nowadays, but also like way back when we were still exploring, for example, the United States and coming upon cultures that we hadn't met before, the assumptions you make and the stories you weave that are completely incorrect because you have your own biases, to see that play out in a story where you as the reader are sort of impartial to what's going on and you can see the mistakes that people make and the assumptions, the incorrect assumptions they make, is really fascinating. But by the end of the story, I was like, I actually wanted to know more and was frustrated that there wasn't more to read. That was it. That was the end of the story.
I think that's a really interesting collection of pieces that you picked, and it does feed into some of the problems that I had with a few things that I was reading too, which is it's a lot to take in. Some of these stuff, some of her material is really dense, and it's, she knows the world so well, but she wants you to know the world well, and these bigger ideas are sometimes buried underneath a lot. And that was a problem that I had with a few things, which I'll talk about when I get there. But first I want to hear what Kristen read, because you completed a whole novel by her.
Yes, I did. I actually listened to the audiobook. Thank God for my job and allowing me to listen to it. It's actually a really different story, and that's the only way to describe it. When I first read the description, which I'll read for you in a second because it's pretty short, the only thing that kind of like came to mind was, okay, you know, I've seen Inception, this makes some sense. Here's the description. George Orr is a man who discovers he has the peculiar ability to dream things into being, for better or for worse. In desperation, he consults a psychotherapist who promises to help him, but who, it soon becomes clear, has his own plans for George and his dreams. This book is so different and interesting, and it brings up some really intense, like, moral questions. When you start the book, you find out that, yeah, George is this guy who dreams, and the first example they give you of things coming true is that he is at his house as a child, or as a teenager, I believe, and his aunt kind of, like, it's not really like abusive or anything, or she doesn't really cross the line, but she's always kind of in his face, and she's kind of I don't even know how to describe it, but she's not a good person. And he goes to sleep one night and dreams that she You know, in Los Angeles, he lived in Portland at the time. In Los Angeles, she was hit by a car and died. And he wakes up the next morning, and that has become reality. And she died like 6 weeks before that. So she had never come to live with him. She had never been in his house. And he's like, wait, what? And so coming to terms with finding out that you have this ability is like, it changes his whole world. So he, you know, in this, it's kind of a, it's a little bit dystopian because they exist in this world that's in our time, but they, it's overpopulated. There's food shortages. You're dealing with, rationing drugs. So every person has like a prescription card, and every person is allowed a certain allotment based on diseases and things that they're dealing with. And he borrows prescription cards from his friends in order to get drugs and things that will allow him not to dream. He's trying to suppress his dreams and sleep soundlessly. So he gets caught doing that, and that's how he ends up at the psychotherapist. And from there, this psychotherapist has this machine that he hooks him into that allows him to kind of influence his dreams, and it just snowballs. Like, you see this whole world change every time he wakes up, and sometimes the changes are minor, like a painting changes in the hallway, and sometimes the changes are drastic and major, like the earth is no longer overcrowded, and he's basically responsible for millions of people just disappearing. And it just, it's insane. Like, the scope of this book and the story it's telling are something I could never have even like imagined, but it's a really compelling story. The end is kind of trippy. It's a little bit out there. I want to actually sit down and read it in text and see if I can like follow it a little better. Because I kind of got a little lost at the end, but up until then, I had followed it and was really impressed by it. Like, it's just a really crazy story.
Wow, that sounds really intense, but also kind of awesome. And, like, I like the connection you made to, like, Inception-y. That sounds really, I think I would have to listen to that, actually.
It was a really good listen, I will say. Like, the author does a good job, and yeah, it was not a hard book to listen to at all.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. The book I read, I still have about 100 pages left, and it was really interesting. It is the first book in the Heinisch cycle, and the reason I chose this book was because of the cycle, not so much what the book was. I actually picked I don't know how to pronounce 95% of the terms that Ursula has come up with, but
yep.
which is yep. Also like, you know, when I first read Harry Potter, I was very frustrated because I could not figure out how to pronounce Hermione's name in my head, and so that drove me crazy. But this is another thing that, so the Heinisch cycle is all about like interplanetary relationships, and these planets are trying to, you know, it was very, as soon as you hear me explain it, you'll know I chose it because it's the closest you could get to Star Trek without it being Star Trek. So these planets are finally figuring out that they can communicate. They don't have the capability of travel, but they do kind of have the ability to talk with one another. And there's all these different types of people that they meet across all of the books. They're like learning about new genetics, and they're finding like people who can, one of the examples that the Wikipedia page for the whole cycle gives is there are people that they meet who can like dream while they're awake, and those who are only sexually active once a month, and then they can choose their gender when that happens. And it's really, it's just, other than that, they're just, like, asexual, and, like, it's, there's so much in here, and it kind of, her father, I should have mentioned this earlier, was an anthropologist, and so a lot of her interest growing up was very academic and, like, you know, urban legend, and hearing about different people and their customs and all sorts of stuff. So then I pick up the first book, I'm like, all right, I'm going to read these in order, and apparently you can read them in order, but you do not have to, because they're all just part of this world, but they don't feed on each other. which I wish I had known because I would have read her most famous work, The Left Side of Darkness, but I didn't read that. I read Rokanon's World, which, wow. It's about basically an anthropologist who is studying this new, like, backwards-y type planet, and there's gnomes and goblins, and there's some, like, dwarves there, and it's, you know, it's really interesting. It's very, very, very fairy tale-esque and definitely more fantasy than what I thought I was getting into when I picked this series. But I do want to finish it because, you know, it did kind of remind me as I was getting into it of the books that I really like that I mentioned earlier, the Jules Verne books, and they're trying to figure out travel, and they're trying to, like, get off of these planets, and they're trying, but then they're also, like, initiating, like, peace initiatives and trying to, like, get people to cooperate, and but also taking great logs and figuring out, you know, who these people are and what they're capable of. Some of them are, like, capable of telepathy, and then there's, like, these, like, really awesome the organizational system of the, like, dwarves and gnome tribes are so cool. Like, it's, you know, it's something that I want to see, and these aren't being adapted, unfortunately, but this would be, if someone wrote this today, it would have a, you know, 8-episode Amazon order already. So I don't know what people are doing, or if she ties up the rights to her works or something, but it's all really incredible. But I'm mainly looking forward to finishing up the first book and getting really deep into this cycle, because there's so much here, and she wrote
short stories that go with it, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of short stories that go with it.
I think I read one of them.
Yeah, there's a ton of them that feed into this world, and that's another great thing. Like, if you don't really want to read another novel, you have other options to go to, but you're still in this universe. But The Left Hand of Darkness is one of her most famous books. It was written in 1969, and this one, it won the Hugo, and it won the Nebula Award in science fiction. So, and then another book later on in this series, The Dispossessed, also won the Hugo and Nebula. So she really hit a stride here. And one of the interesting things about this series, too, is that she took a very long break from writing these, like 20, 30 years. And then she came back and wrote some more stories and collections of work that went into this series. And that came at a time when she really started to find a different voice. And that leads me to the other thing that I read, which was a commencement address that she gave at Miller College called The Left-Handed Commencement Address. And it kind of plays off of her, you know, most famous novel, The Left Hand of Darkness. But she really had a hard time figuring out what a woman's voice is. And she was always writing in a male's voice. And when she started to make a change later in her writing career and trying to unpack what it means to write as a woman, she always felt like she was playing in, you know, a man's playground and just taking his tools and making them work for him, for a male audience. And when she stopped doing that, you know, people really didn't like her work that was coming out of that. And so in this commencement address, it was a co-ed college, but mostly women, but there were, like, a few men who were graduating in that class. And she basically says at the top of the address, like, I'm sorry, you're here. You can take this advice too, but I'm talking to the women here. And she tells them that, you know, like, don't settle for the man's world. Like, do not play in his rules. Do not fight his rules either, though. Do not live in opposition. Live on your own. and do what makes you happy, because if you are fighting against what's already established, you're letting them win, basically, and you're feeding into what they want. They live in conflict, and you need to get out of the world of conflict and forge your own path. And if you want kids, you want kids. Like, don't ask anyone else what they want. If you want things, you want them. And it was just a really cool address, and she just hits – it's very clunky in the beginning, and I don't think she really knew where she was going with it, but at the end, she really hit her stride with driving home, just really sticking to your guns, and who cares if 25 years into your writing career you want to change the voice that you're writing in, because it doesn't matter. And then I read, finally, another one of her more famous pieces, which is The Ones Who Walk Away from Amelas. And this is a short story, but it's one of the most studied stories of hers. And it's because it tackles this question of, if you are put into this utopia and everything is perfect, everyone is completely happy, everyone who is happy understands what happiness is and is just living this beautiful life. But in order to live that beautiful life, you have to know that a child is locked away in a dungeon somewhere suffering. What do you do? Do you stay there? And it kind of grapples with these people who are coming through, and do they stay? Do they leave? And if they are staying, are they actually happy? Because they do somewhere in their mind know that a child is suffering somewhere in order to allow this happiness. So I thought that was a little too deep for me to read.
Wow.
Yeah. On my lunch break. Whoa. At work.
That's like, man.
Yeah, I really like ran the gamut with her. I was like, all right, I'm reading about dragons and dwarves and all sorts of awesome things here that I wasn't expecting to, because I thought I was going to read about Star Trek. And now I'm reading about finding my own voice, and I'm feeling really empowered, and now children are locked in dungeons. And so she's just so fascinating, and I'm sorry I keep gushing about her, but I really found an author that I'm excited to dive into and explore more. So for the next few weeks on Book Hype, I hope you're all ready to hear all the latest Ursula Le Guin I've read.
That's nice. Cool, though, that you found somebody who has such an established career in which you can go back and explore all these things that they're all maybe not finished, because I don't know, like, if she continues to add these days, but there's so much to go back and see. And not only that, there's so much that's already been studied and talked about that if you want to find a place where people kind of dive into it the way that you want to dive into it, you can do that. That's there. It's so frustrating when you find a new author that you really like and they've written a book or two books and nobody really knows anything about them. I mean, I like those too for different reasons, but sometimes when the world is so vast, you can really just be consumed by it. That is also very exciting.
Yeah, like, one of the things I think I'm going to kind of take away from all this is just how big the book world is. She's this incredibly influential, you know, largely known author that I had never heard of. And her stuff is like, it runs the gamut. She's got, you know, all kinds of different genre work and all kinds of different ideas and all thoughts and that. And it floors me that I had never heard her name before this article in the Washington Post and us talking about it. And now to like look at everything she's got and everything she's done, it just amazes me that I had never heard her name before.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And something that I really also took away from this whole thing is that how did I not know about her? Like, it's just her writing and everything that she has accomplished, and you know, it's just it's unbelievable how much is out there and the very little that is paid to some authors. Like, you see a James Patterson and everyone is like, oh, James Patterson, I know who that is, but they probably couldn't tell you anything that they've ever read by him, you know. It's like, but then there's these authors who have just really written great work and are just they're not that they feel that they're not being paid their due, because, you know, some authors, like, I don't feel like Ursula Le Guin is suffering at all from, you know, a tortured life of not being recognized, but she also is just very, like, she should be recognized. Like, I almost feel like I want to, you know, shout from the rooftops that everybody should at least look into her life, because she is a fascinating woman, and I'm glad we have the Book Hype platform to do that. So I'm glad a random news article sparked all of this.
Yeah, I love it when that happens.
Yeah. All right, so I will stop talking about her. You have not heard the last of me talking about her, unfortunately, though, so get ready. Next week, we are going to talk about our October book, which is Cursed by Jennifer L. Armentrout. Talk about names I'm just having such a hard time with today. This is an older book. It should be available in your library if you haven't picked it up yet. It's a little spookier and, you know, weird and interesting selection for October, but we went with something a little older that none of us had read, and we're looking forward to breaking it down for you in our book review episode. So thanks for letting me host and take over and talk about Ursula. And until next time, I'm Brittany.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Kristen.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.